Bears. They beat Carolina. That's a bit of an upset. Final score there was 17-3. Tonight for Monday Night Football, Washington and Philadelphia. In the NBA, the Bucks, they take on Charlotte up in Milwaukee. And Major League Baseball, the World Series starts tomorrow. The Dodgers and the Astros, game number one, will be in Los Angeles. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, October the 23rd. Should be cloudy all day, 50-50 chance of more rain. We'll see some patchy morning fog as well, a high of 59. Tonight, light rain and fog. Overnight low 45, and then tomorrow, Tuesday, cloudy, windy, rainy, and chilly. Tomorrow winds up to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow's high only 49. Here are the numbers now. Wind from the north at 3, overcast, and 50 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're beginning the week of morning shows with Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College, paying his monthly visit to the program. Just a quick word about the next couple of days on the program. Tomorrow I'll be speaking with James Nyber. He is a local author of various topics related to the entertainment industry, and we always have fun with James Nyber. This particular time, we're going to be talking about one of his most recent books, which is devoted to some of the most famous monster movies of all time, movies like Dracula and Frankenstein and The Wolfman and so on. And on Wednesday, we look forward to a conversation with Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, in a program which is devoted to modern-day manufacturing, or what's sometimes called manufacturing 4.0, the ways in which the world of manufacturing have changed quite dramatically in recent years. And October has been declared Manufacturing Month, and we'll be talking, among other things, about the long history of manufacturing here in the state of Wisconsin and what might be ahead in light of, among other things, the now pretty much certain arrival in the area of Foxconn. So some interesting programs coming up in the next several days, including the one today with Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War. His column appears in a number of different newspapers across the country. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the program.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Berg. I always enjoy being here.
Good to have you here.
Whatever the weather outside, yeah, political and otherwise.
It's frightful, but yes, we're glad you made your way through the...
You're not referring to the political weather.
Well,
or are you?
Maybe
yes.
I am as well. Maybe I am as well. We have lots and lots of things to talk about. And actually, one of the first that might be interesting to talk about, speaking of the weather, is the fact that the country has been buffeted by all kinds of really disastrous turns, including multiple hurricanes and some of the most devastating wildfires that have ever been seen in the state of California. Of course, in some respects, one of the stories that has been of most persistent challenge for the current president and his administration has been the matter of Puerto Rico. And I think for a lot of Americans, we're talking about Puerto Rico for the first time in quite some time. I mean, in terms of the fact that these are American citizens and apparently have experienced something exceptionally difficult. And, of course, all of these stories also bring to mind the question of what is the U.S. government's function when such massive and serious natural disasters occur, and the price tag that is attached with the help that needs to be given. What do you make of this really, really challenging bundle of challenges?
Well, you're right that it's challenging politically as well as in public policy, sheer human and humanitarian relief terms. Americans, for all the terrible qualities of the 20th century, Americans rather profoundly move toward expecting the President of the United States to provide, to spearhead leadership in providing humanitarian relief. Up until the 20th century, natural disasters were what people used to refer to, the way people used to talk, not so much anymore. An act of God. In other words, you've got to be fatalistic, just as our children died and just as we face suffering and hardship and perhaps even starvation, certainly fires and natural disasters. This is just part of life. And one of the great strengths, I think, of the United States, starting with our Constitution, is we don't have to accept that. We can make things better in the future. And that's something that separates us, I think, from other countries. To actually answer your question, President, it is a political minefield, therefore, and George W. Bush in office, there was a photograph that went viral, as people say nowadays, not referring to disease, but to information and misinformation spreading, rather like the Emperor of Rome. He was staring down from the window of Air Force One, high above the area devastated by Katrina during his administration, and he suffered. So within a couple of days, not a couple of hours, but a couple of days, the President of the United States in his cowboy outfit, this very urban fellow, of course, was very good at coming across like a regular guy, unlike his dad. And there he was in a work shirt and blue jeans out there on the bayous lifting sandbags. Lyndon Johnson, the first big, really big billion-dollar hurricane was Betsy in the Gulf in 1965, and LBJ at that time still quite popular in the wake of the 64 election and other things. At 3 and 4 in the morning, the President of the United States, followed by extremely nervous Secret Service men and state and local officials and politicians who really wished everybody drenched in rain and at least knee-deep in water. He was pounding on shacks, shining a flashlight on his own face. The President of the United States is here. Your president is. You are not alone. You are not alone. It was that earlier America that gave rise to LBJ and other populist politicians who really resonated the idea that government must help people to a better life. Earlier, Herbert Hoover and Teddy Roosevelt. I'm already, you know, going on at excessive length, as usual. But Theodore Roosevelt, and then greatly reinforced by Hoover, really cemented this expectation and now tradition that the federal government will provide widespread relief, very contrary to the way we started out looking at the world.
Yeah. One of the most intriguing lines, I think, about some of these most recent stories is, I believe it was the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, who spoke quite harshly,
right,
in terms of what she felt was the lack of response from the government, and she was really aiming her criticism at the president, rightly or wrongly, mm-hmm, in a way that was really interesting to me, because it sort of in a sense capsulized sort of the no holds barred, the gloves are off sort of times in which we live. I think once upon a time, the mayor of a city would have been quite hesitant, even under the most difficult of circumstances, to express frustration in the unguarded way that she did. It seems to be a sign of the times in terms of how we say what we say, even in these kind of circumstances.
You're referring perhaps to a long-term decline of authority in the U.S., if I understand you correctly. Is that it?
No, it's more just...
we used to respect the president, for example.
Right. That's
once upon a time, young man. Yeah.
And I think people would have also been... I mean, even if the president was someone that you personally did not support or were not in concert with politically... Nevertheless, you would have chosen your words very, very carefully, no matter how frustrated you were. And it just seems like we are in an era now where that is less apt to happen.
Yes, I certainly agree with you, and not just because I'm old, about the decline of manners and etiquette and general politeness in the public space. Privately is where people used to misbehave. If that's what you're saying, I agree with you. At the same time, we've had lots of special tension with Puerto Rico, where the population has citizenship rights, but they are not a state. And because of the fact that it was basically an imperial relationship, it was not that long ago Puerto Rican nationalists shot up literally the House of Representatives, shot some members of the House during the Truman administration, and came very close to killing the president of the United States, partly because he was not living in the White House. He was living in Blair House, and in those days,
right,
you only had a few Secret Service men even around the president, and it was a near-run thing. Political violence is nothing new in this country, and it's extremely important that we keep that in mind. Also, to actually mention a fact, it appears to be that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency or administration set up by Jimmy Carter, while I'm dropping names of presidents, they performed rather well by all actual factual reports, not only regarding Puerto Rico, but also these set of hurricanes that we've had. George W. Bush suffered politically not just because of the famous photo, but he had appointed one of his country club buddies to run FEMA, and there were some serious missteps and a lot of problems in disaster relief connected with Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
One function of the bad manners you were referring to is the fact that we live in a highly emotional universe in terms of public discussion, and for that reason, this kind of constant screaming and constant anguish and, it's a big change. You're right.
Right.
And I think that's what you were referring to, mainly.
Right. I may have overstated.
That's all right.
In the sense, I mean,
the time in which we live.
Right. I wasn't trying to. I wasn't trying to accuse her of bad manners, so much as a lack of restraint.
Yeah. Well, she's in a tough spot politically,
and being
an executive.
You're right, and being completely unguarded in terms of, for instance, expressing her frustration.
Yeah.
That seems to be emblematic of the times in which we live. It's not a time in which too many people are circumspect when it comes to,
that's right,
expressing, for instance, frustration or disdain for an opinion with which you disagree. We are living in plain-spoken, blunt times in terms of how we express ourselves.
Circumspect, a good word, circumspect.
about to go extinct, probably. At any rate...
Well, actually, the BBC is increasing its market, thanks significantly to NPR and also public television. And I think a public desire for actual facts, reliable information, and circumspection, which is a term I associate with our British friends, I think that's a big reason why they're expanding.
Right. While we're talking politics, for a moment, let's talk about politics in the nation of one of our most important allies, Japan.
Yes.
And the elections which just occurred there, which I believe re-elected the incumbent. Tell us, give us a little background on this election and whether or not these results were ever in any significant doubt.
This last election, no. Japan has had a series of revolving door prime ministers for a couple of decades. And as James Fallows, an expert on Japan and a very fine journalist and author, put it in a public lecture I attended a while ago, there's a new guy in Japan. There's always a new guy in Japan. And he's there for a year or two, and then we get another new guy.
Mm.
And it was stated bluntly, I hope not crudely. He was referring to the fact that it's been very, very difficult to have durable executive leadership. Prime Minister Abe now provides that, and I believe that's all to the good. The Liberal Democratic Party, except for, I believe, a brief tenure by the Socialists not long after World War II, the LDP has been in a long-term dominant position. I believe opposition parties could not literally get their act together. There was some fracturing of parties. Things seemed to be more divided and factionalized than usual in Japan. He's clearly a very strong leader, and I believe a very positive one from our point of view. There are some American ambassadorships. It's literally awful that we have so many slots currently unfilled. But one ambassadorship that was filled rather promptly, I'm glad to say, was our ambassador to Japan. Hmm. And sometimes political appointees, especially in the case of Britain, were you can do a lot of damage and the alliance remains strong. Political appointees are named. William F. Hagerty, our ambassador to Japan, was confirmed rather quickly by the Senate. He has a financial background, which is certainly not necessarily bad. He has experience in Japan and Asia of a practical business sort, which I think is to the good. I think the gold standard in terms of U.S. ambassadors to Japan since the war were James Ingersoll, Nixon's ambassador, and Edwin Reischauer, a Harvard professor appointed by President Kennedy. I think Nixon and Kennedy, especially Kennedy, really are impressive. And if you're interested in that dimension, and if you're interested in presidents who appointed effective ambassadors, as the Trump administration unfolds, you should really put it in the context, which is easy to do nowadays, of our previous ambassadors.
You were saying earlier something about so many slots left unfilled. So I think you were referring specifically to the position of ambassador.
I believe other positions in the State Department have also. It's been moving rather slowly. At the same time, I think Rex Tillerson has been a strong Secretary of State, a strong executive. And the fact that professionals in the department feel left out or are complaining off the record to the media isn't necessarily bad. As usual, it's mixed and complicated, but I in no way mean to suggest I'm criticizing Tillerson's performance overall. I think he's shown a lot of courage in standing up within reason to the president, and I think he... which is essential if you're going to be successful in that job. He demonstrates just phenomenal energy.
Mm-hmm. He's off to Afghanistan, I think, even as we speak.
Well, there you go.
Right. another word about ambassadors. Can you just say a word about what the significance of ambassadors is? That is, what is it that they do? And I guess I'm asking because then the second question then is, what does it mean when, for instance, the post of ambassador to the nation of, I don't know, India or Pakistan or whatever, is vacant? I mean, what is not happening in the event that an ambassadorship goes unfilled or is only filled very slowly?
They keep things from going wrong by doing their best to maintain stability, understanding, and positive rapport with other countries. It's especially important when it's a major power like Japan or Germany or China or Russia. Even if we have well-established alliance relations, it's especially important since the Cold War when economic frictions have an opportunity to rise to the forefront that we maintain good, positive relations. So a lot of what the average woman and average man might see is a waste of time if you're busy struggling, you know, on a shop floor in an office to get your work done and earn a living. An awful lot of the social functions that may seem superficial are exactly extremely important to their work. If you've got a major ambassadorship, there's always something going wrong, and there's always a visiting delegation from Congress, and taking care of day-to-day pressures makes it a very challenging job, because the most important work, of course, is anticipating problems, trying to manage the strategy of your job. I think it's a very, very difficult job. Right. And I knew Reischauer slightly because he came to visit the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, and he was back at Harvard University when I had the opportunity to spent some time there as a graduate student. And I knew Bob Ingersoll rather well because he was a Chicago business leader where I used to work. We've all been around impressive people who seem extremely responsible, intuitive, very good at handling their surroundings outside of the library or the formal hierarchical meeting. And both those men seem to me to excel at that.
It kind of occurs to me that ambassadors are the kind of people in our governmental structure that we tend to know relatively little about, and you're right, we tend not to understand what they do.
It's also a dangerous job, as is the Foreign Service generally. I'm sorry to have interrupted you more than usual this morning, but since about 1970, American diplomats are now getting killed at a rate that wasn't the case even during wartime before. Because there's a real downside to killing an ambassador, but with the growth of very violent, nationalist, terrorist, extremist movements of all kinds, not just the Islamic groups we currently focus on, it's become a dangerous occupation. And you don't get rich, really. It's a very dedicated group of people. I've met a lot of them over the years, and I'm really impressed by the Foreign Service.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage and Director of the Clausen Center. And Dr. Sear visits us here at the Morning Show once a month, and we appreciate each and every one of his visits.
Being here. Thank you. It's part of my work for the college. And even though Tom Clausen is no longer with us, I certainly want to live up to the spirit of what he had in mind, and this is the kind of thing he had in mind,
of course.
I can assure you.
While we're talking politics in other places, let's talk for a moment about the rather dramatic events within the boundaries of Spain and that region known as Catalonia, which seems to be a source of some turbulence, and apparently
right.
There are a lot of Catalonians who would like to generate something resembling independence, some sort of separation from the nation of Spain. What can you tell us about this and the background of this unrest?
Spain is a country on which I'm not an expert, let me emphasize, but there is long-established regional sentiment and tension between the central and regional government of the sort that I believe is present throughout Europe, except France, perhaps. The decline of intense nationalism, which grew in the 19th century, I think, starting with the French Revolution, and then reached extreme, intense, very violent forms in the 20th century, contributed to the two world wars, among other problems. That has declined, and there are lots of positive things connected with it, but I do think that that broadly has given rise to separatist sentiments. There's been an election in Italy just before we speak, which I have yet to catch up with, frankly, that reflects regional sentiments. Certainly the Scottish National Party in Britain, the Welsh Nationalists in a less powerful way, but Britain has been challenged, especially since the 1950s, with growing separatist movements. The growth of third parties in Britain and elsewhere reflects this. I'm very glad to say that, and we should all be happy about the fact, that insofar as I know, Germany and Japan are remarkably free of this, just as Prime Minister Abe, like Chancellor Merkel in Germany, is a very effective, very low-key leader, criticized for being bland and in fundamental ways pretty reassuring for the population. That's all to the good. But there's nothing new about separatism in Spain. I do think that, in contrast to the British, for instance, Spanish authorities have a habit of cracking down, sometimes pretty violently, with police action that's almost certainly counterproductive. That's happened with the Catalonia vote, and I'm sure that's only going to feed this sentiment.
Right.
But I don't think there's a revolution coming, and I don't think Franco is returning. My allusions to Germany and Japan, I don't think that this signifies any kind of sea change. It's a broad movement in not just Europe, but internationally.
Right. I suspect that part of what makes it especially acute in a place like Spain is the fact that there are real differences, significant differences in language in these various regions.
Right.
Very different kinds of Spanish, and I only know that from a couple of years ago when the Carthage Choir traveled to Spain. I didn't go with them, but I remember some of the preliminary conversations about that from Dr. Garcia Novelli explaining this, that that it isn't just one kind of Spanish that is spoken in Spain. And that
interesting,
and these significant variations in the Spanish language, according to region, probably seek to underscore some of these separatist sentiments in a way that probably maybe is not quite so acute in other places where everybody shares a very, very similar language.
It would probably be helpful to. Certainly me, if I interviewed you one of these days and we turned the tables, culture underlies the kind of political and economic developments that we focus on when you have me on your show. But you're absolutely right, culture is key. And one other country where separatist and regional sentiments of an intense sort have not been prominent is the United States. I believe George Wallace with the American Independent Party in 68 and then until he was shot in 72, that was a movement and a party that threatened, it really did threaten our national cohesion and stability. He came within literally tens of thousands of votes in Ohio and Tennessee in 68 of throwing a very close election into the House of Representatives. And for all our complaining and all our fearfulness nowadays in the states and this sort of nasty atmosphere that is real and you mentioned earlier, we're not facing that kind of third-party challenge, and we're not facing regional breakaway sentiments that have been so costly in this country. It's not reflected in our national political system or in our national dialogue. Confederate statues, the issue du jour a few days or weeks ago, the intense media focus compared to North-South challenges, not just during the intense conversation between 1861 and 1865, but in our party politics. We're not a homogeneous country, but our own regional frictions have really faded.
Yeah, in large measure.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. And cultural, the cultural insight is really key. And I hope you'll continue to explore this interest in Spain, and then I'll interview you.
There you go. Let's talk for a moment about Iran and the fact that President Trump moved very aggressively in, I think the term he used was decertifying.
That's it.
This agreement that you write about being very carefully brokered by former Secretary of State John Kerry.
Yeah.
In the column that you wrote about this, among your major concerns about what the president is currently doing regarding Iran is the fact that we're talking about an agreement that was not just between us and Iran. It was not involving two nations, but a number of our allies.
Mm-hmm.
And you have grave concerns about what the president is doing with an agreement that has ramifications beyond what happens in Iran. Explain what you see as the serious problem here.
Well, Iran was brought to the negotiating table, and then through very, very tough negotiations, Iran is rightly respected and notorious for being extremely difficult to negotiate with. UN sanctions, spearheaded by the major countries that are represented on the Security Council, not just the U.S., but Britain, France, China, Russia, particularly important given Putin's successful efforts to develop closer ties with Iran, plus Germany, P5 plus one in the shorthand vernacular, led by the United States, to be sure, but this multilateral agreement was worked out whereby sanctions would be lifted and especially a large amount of money frozen, Iran assets in the United States, not our money, their money, which had been frozen since the revolution and the hostage crisis of 1979, was returned to Iran, and the sanctions were generally lifted. They were coming close to wrecking Iran's economy, and Iran does have a rather sophisticated, compared to other countries in the Mideast, it's not really a developing country in the sense that they have a very sophisticated professional infrastructure and a relatively sophisticated economy, I believe. They wanted that relief. We have active inspections through the International Atomic Energy Agency, a very durable and reliable international agency. And that agency, in contrast to the president's statement, has regularly confirmed that Iran is within compliance, just within compliance. But they are staying within the complicated boundaries of this very technical agreement. Kerry, another Secretary of State who demonstrated remarkable energy and dedication, I think he deserves a lot of credit for maneuvering, for leading this. He seemed to be working 25 hours a day, eight days a week, dealing with Congress and the conservative media hostility in this country, as well as these complicated negotiations. But we're the only partner. The most important point, as I ramble on here, that we're the only partner that is threatening to back out. The increasing isolation of the United States internationally, which I believe is a feature of the Trump administration and the president's approach to the world, will only be greatly reinforced if we abandon it. And as usual with President Trump, in my view, there's been a lot of rhetoric. There's been a television performance. But actually, unless Congress acts, it doesn't have any impact on the agreement. Or in general terms, the U.S. is becoming more isolated in the world, and economic steps are increasing protection. But he's not breaking the agreement. He's not walking away from the agreement, just as the NATO alliance continues and is very durable, even though the president slapped the German chancellor in the face and insulted our European allies generally on his Bull in a China shop trip to Europe early in his administration. He refused to shake her hands. He didn't literally slap her in the face, but you were referring earlier to the importance of diplomacy.
Right.
And diplomacy we could use more of right now.
Right. So in other words, President Trump's dismissive rhetoric about this agreement is not the same thing as this agreement being voided.
That's right. Thank you for summing up in a few clear words what I was trying to say. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right. One other thing you said in that column that I found intriguing was when you quote former President Richard Nixon, apparently writing in one of his last books.
I think his last book, yes.
Okay, characterizing the difference between Iran and Iraq. And I think the quote is something to the effect that they are both enemies of the United States, but Iran, a far greater enemy or more significant threat
yes.
to us than Iraq. And it had to do with the very nature of the two nations and how different they are from one another, one in effect being sacred, the other being secular. Explain what former President Nixon was saying there, and if that remains true today, is it as true as it might have been when he first wrote those words back in, I think, the 1990s?
Yeah. I get the titles mixed up. He wrote about six books after he left the White House, and Beyond Peace was... I think his last one. They're well worth reading. They're like the man himself. This is not inspirational material. it is challenging. It's very disciplined. A lot of detail on foreign policy by someone who was extremely effective, in my opinion, in both foreign and domestic policy terms. His point, his prediction has been confirmed that we should try to balance them off against each other. And he wrote, in effect, that if we overturned Saddam's regime. Saddam Hussein in Iraq was a secular nationalist, and Iraq is not a threat to the United States today as a nation. Iraq is a wreck. It's a totally chaotic mess with some rather courageous leaders who struggled to hold it together. But the dominant regime was Sunni. The basic distinction between Sunni and Shia in the Islamic world, the Shias are by far the majority, in both countries, but more generally in the Islamic world. And Iran is a principal Shia leader. By destroying Iraq, we not only created an unholy rat's nest, a real swamp of misery, human suffering, mass killing of civilians, by the way, which does not receive much attention and which continues in this terrible war in Syria, but also provide an opportunity for Iran to increase its regional influence, which they've done. This was a decade before we attacked Iraq in the spring of 2003. The capacity of Nixon and also Eisenhower to see down the road in an almost eerie way in foreign policy, I find quite impressive. And it's one reason both were successful in policy terms, even though much criticized at the time for different reasons.
Right.
At the times they were in office.
And I think your final point in this really important column is the fact.
Well, thank
that,
you for saying it's important.
Is the fact that when important changes in policy are made, or if they're even talked about, rather than enacted. That care needs to be taken with what the consequences of that might be, including consequences unforeseen or beyond the obvious.
Yeah.
And that would seem, I think the point you're making is that seems to be a characteristic largely lacking in President Trump, that when he reacts to something in a very visceral way, in many cases he appears at least to not be thinking about the consequences of if I say this or if I do this, it might feel good in the moment, it might make my base happy, but there are important allies who might be quite unhappy, or it may undermine certain other relationships that are very crucial to the United States. That I think that's what you're saying in your column, that he seems to be reckless when it comes
to this.
That's
not the thrust of the column, though.
Right.
And I want to actively resist and do, on public media especially public radio, this nonstop chorus of criticism of President Trump. I think it's extremely unproductive. Since I have the opportunity to appear on your program, I voiced my sentiments quite bluntly concerning what I thought of him and what I thought of his candidacy. I think the office of the presidency deserves respect, and I think you and I are most well served, and your listeners especially, by not simply repeating the constant chorus now, in my opinion, on public radio of disdain and dislike and disagreement and obvious hostility to the president. I don't want to offend you, but I do think it's becoming so pervasive that it's unhealthy as well as unproductive. Just my opinion. The president doesn't actually seem to do much. There are moves in the economic sphere, especially concerning NAFTA, that are encouraging protectionism. But he's basically, and we can thank God for it, again, bluntly, he talks, but he doesn't actually follow through much.
Right.
And I think it's why the staff around him is so important. General John Kelly, currently, most importantly. In terms of what I tried to emphasize in the column, it was two things. We should try to emulate the standard that a previous president set, Nixon, and also others. And also, we haven't talked about what I thought was important in the column, and thank you again for the compliment. There's a lot of change going on in Iran. It's never been a monolithic dictatorship, unlike Saddam Hussein's Iraq. President Ahmadinejad sits on top of a shifting coalition of mullahs and interest groups that have a large middle class, including a female middle class, very active men and women. They do have elections that are reasonably reflective of public sentiment. It's not our kind of system, but it's not an old-fashioned dictatorship. And there is a lot of opening up going up in Iran that's totally ignored by the mass media in
right.
this country, including a charter on citizens' rights that the president put in place as he was campaigning hard for re-election early this year.
I think you call it signs of moderation.
That's the kind of term that sounds like my impression of me, yes, right.
But yes, that there are for however potentially dangerous Iran might be to us, there are signs of moderation there that should not be ignored and also should be encouraged.
They've always shown a lot of restraint as a nation state. They support terrorism, especially against Israel, and they make mischief elsewhere. But during the long, brutal Iran-Iraq war in the 80s, went on for about 8 years, we strongly supported Iraq. While we were supporting them, there was a massive poison gas attack that killed thousands of Iranians, including Kurds. Iran did not respond in kind. The U.S. Navy, the USS Vincennes, quite mistakenly, I believe, shot down a heavily loaded, large Iranian civilian airliner. They thought it was military. Killed hundreds of people, including a number of children. Our government reached a generous financial settlement thereafter with the government of Iran, but they did not respond with any kind of national military counterattack against the United States at the time. It's extremely important that we keep in mind at all times, along with this incendiary rhetoric, not quite up to North Korea standards, but pretty extreme, and rhetorical hostility to what they call the Great Satan, meaning us, they're actually pretty restrained in what they do. And Nixon, like Eisenhower, was always very focused on what are they actually doing and how can we counter various enemies, including the nuclear-armed Soviet Union, without having a direct confrontation.
Interesting.
Yeah. Which is why we didn't have a Cuban Missile Crisis during the Eisenhower administration, bluntly, and why we did have a pretty serious confrontation with Moscow that had a nuclear dimension during the 73 war in the Mideast, but Nixon and Kissinger kept it completely private, which Kennedy could not do. Things had gotten so out of hand by October of 62, the anniversary of which is this month, this week.
Yeah. Scary times.
They were. They really were scary.
Let's go to an important economic theme that you talk about in another recent column, namely the potential repeal of something that's come to be known as the Volcker Rule, which went into effect in 2013 and essentially, I believe, reversed the repeal of Glass-Steagall back in 1999. And remind our listeners what the so-called Volcker Rule is and what it would potentially represent if it were to be either weakened or even dismantled.
Yes. The Volcker Rule reimposes a sort of basic separation between commercial and investment banking. So that commercial banks, the big banks where people have checking accounts and those who still struggle with savings accounts, traditional banks that lend money to people and corporations and other entities, they became strictly regulated during the New Deal. Before that, it really was the Wild West.
Hmm.
And it's important to keep that in mind. Glass and Steagall, two members of Congress, got two bills through, I believe, in the 30s as part of this vast reform of the financial system that President Roosevelt put in place with his associates through the New Deal, and as a way of trying to limit risk, especially for the average American. Those activities were separated. In 1999, in a very different time, as cowboy capitalism was very much in the saddle, if I may carry the metaphor, while Bill Clinton, with the cooperation of financial authorities, basically got rid of Glass-Steagall as part of the deregulation and the growing association of the Democratic Party with Wall Street, for which they're paying the price now, in my opinion. The financial crash of 2008-09 and the resulting recession brought, predictably, and thank goodness for it, a lot of emphasis on reform. And Paul Volcker was able to get this administrative regulation through. It was part of comprehensive reform that I believe were in the omnibus Dodd-Frank bill. Paul Volcker is what we used to refer to as a dedicated public servant. I'm very proud that he was the speaker who inaugurated the Clausen Center at Carthage College in 2004 because he was a close friend of Tom Clausen. That I observed was an unusually close relationship. He's a very durable leader like Tom. He served in the Treasury Department in the Kennedy and Johnson as well as Nixon administrations. Jimmy Carter, who nominated Tom Clausen to be head of the World Bank, also deserves credit for getting Paul Volcker in as head of the Fed. And during the Reagan administration, Volcker really effectively broke the back of inflation, which was killing this this country as well as our economy, along with high unemployment. Volcker really did a magnificent job of pursuing tight money policy and high interest rates, which killed off this devastating inflation. At the time he visited Carthage in 2004, he was taking a lot of heat from the political right and from third world countries and UN bureaucrats for a very important, very thorough analysis of the UN oil for food program, a source of corruption. And he was able to identify culprits and those who weren't, and the UN is better as a result. He also was spearheading a very complicated, totally pretty much unreported effort of the Financial Accounting Standards Board to make foundation, to make accounting standards more uniform in the world. He's still active. He's well worth reading. If anybody quotes Paul Volcker, pay attention. He's somebody worth studying.
Right.
But that's in a nutshell. We're more regular. The banks hate, and I mean they hate, the Volcker Rule, which makes me think it's pretty damn effective. And they're busy diluting it under President Trump, but it's still there, and let's keep it there. Mm. Voters, citizens, I lobby through the means of public radio.
Right. Well, on that note, we finish out what's yet another very interesting conversation. Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, director of the aforementioned Clausen Center, named after Tom Clausen, I appreciate each and every one of these visits, including our visit today, and look forward to seeing you sometime in the month of November. And thank you again for being part of the morning show.
Well, thank you. It's always a tonic for me, and if I get hot on a subject, I hope you understand it's not directed at you personally. I really admire you, Greg.
No problem. Glad to have you here. Tomorrow on the morning show, local author, I'm blanking on the name. All of a sudden, I'm thinking about too many things all at once. We'll be talking about monster movies tomorrow on the morning.